It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're talking about today's frac sand mine hearing with Wisconsin Public Radio news reporter Gilman Halstead.
But first, we're talking about the role of libraries. This week is the Wisconsin Library Association's annual conference, which is going on in Green Bay right now, which got us thinking about libraries here at Central Time.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about libraries? Are you a regular user? What do you do there? Do you think they're still important? Call in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Before the conversation, in the interest of full disclosure, I'll point out that I am married to a librarian. Not this one, though. Paula Gagnier joins us. She's Wisconsin Library Association President, Library Director of the David Cofran Library at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Paula, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be with you. To have an opportunity to talk about libraries is always one of my favorite things.
All right. Well, a lot of people, I think if you polled people on the street and said, define a library, they're going to say something like, it's a place where you borrow books. What else is a library?
Well, a library, I think, is an anchor, or I like to call a cornerstone of a community. It's a place where people can come together to enrich their lives, to enrich their family lives, to make a community a better place. It's a place where not only can you take books, you can also take classes. You can check out the latest technology. You can apply for jobs at the library if you don't have internet access. It's pretty much everything to do whatever you might need to do. Libraries are trying to provide that to people.
There are arguments out there sometimes, you know, with the internet, with the access to information we have. Are libraries still needed? I'm guessing anybody in the library trade hears that from time to time. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. And they say it loudly. While it used to be librarians were the gatekeepers of information, which we've long ago not been, what we are, though, are the guides to help you through. There is so much information out there. And you need to be making the right choices about what information you need for whatever particular issue or problem you're trying to solve, and the trained librarians, the experts, can help you make that a whole lot easier.
I've heard that with the recession of the last handful of years, libraries saw a lot more people coming through the door, both for materials and to use things like the job finding services you talked about. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, one of the things that happens when the economy takes a downturn, people have to start giving up the extras, giving up that monthly bill for internet access. And so we're going to go to the library to get the internet access. Instead of going to a movie that's going to cost you $8, $10, it's going to last for 2 hours, we'll go check out a book or a DVD from the library that we don't have to pay for and we can keep for a lot longer and enjoy for a lot longer. So you see a lot of that. You see definitely an increase in the number of people who are coming in to apply for jobs. You know, actually a lot of jobs nowadays you're applying for online. It's your only option. And so people have to come in and do that, but then they also need some help learning how to use the computer, how to, you know, fill out one of those forms that they've never had to do before. I mean, then sometimes we're teaching them how to use the mouse for the very first time. So there's all sorts of things that we've done to help people get to apply for these jobs and hopefully successfully find them. For example, Fond du Lac Public Library converted a meeting space into a job center, and it's quite a busy spot. Our keynote speaker today from the UK, he runs the Idea Stores, and they have been doing a great deal of making sure there's job center spots in their libraries as well.
So. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Dave with us in Genoa City. Dave, hi.
How are you today?
Real good. What do you use libraries for?
We recently turned off our satellite TV and our internet services because exactly what your host had said about the increase in the cost. And we go down there to rent DVDs, use the internet to check out books. A lot of times we just go down there to sit down and relax and talk.
All right. Is that a pretty common story, do you think, Paula?
It is, and it's the ones we love to hear. And so I'm thrilled that Dave is using his local public library, and, you know, please keep doing that. It's amazing the things that can happen when someone does go in there, and even just to talk. You never know when the next idea, the next innovation is going to come out of those things.
Well, speaking of innovation, the conference theme for the Wisconsin Library Association this year is Play, Create, Innovate. Why is that your theme this year?
Well, you know, we're all so overworked, and not just librarians, everybody. This world is moving at such a fast pace that sometimes we forget to play. And so if you don't take the time to play, you don't have the time to be creative, and it's that time when you play and create where the innovations come from. You can't just sit down and say, I'm going to be innovative today, and I'm going to create something, you know, fabulous. They come as sparks. So we felt that it was really important for the librarians to have that opportunity. So one of the things we wanted to do at this conference was give them the time to play and create in hopes that they take this now back to their libraries where new innovations can happen and we can continue to meet the needs of our customers and our communities.
So how can librarians help their customers, their patrons, play and create?
We are now creating spaces in our libraries. Some people refer to them as maker spaces. We're having areas where it might be crafts to help for adults to have a chance to just relax and do something fun. We have these maker spaces. They can be made up of all sorts of different things. So there might be a 3D printer available. There might be your typical arts and crafts things that people can come in and play around with an idea and, you know, let me try this, and wow, look at that. You know, I've been able to fix this problem now just by having these various spots where people can come together. There's so much that comes out of a library. The ideas, I get stories all the time where somebody will tell me, you know, one of my favorite things about a library was to do this, and I did this here. It's wonderful to hear all of the stories that come in, and a librarian or a library was at the heart of helping them fix that problem.
Is this something that's pretty common across the country already, or is this kind of cutting-edge library science here?
The makerspaces are starting to pop up throughout, so we're sort of on the beginning of it. And I think as one of the things we have done as librarians over the years been so well at is continually changing and trying to keep up with the technology. People think of the libraries, oh, the old card catalogs and the stuffy old books, but we've been changing for years, and this is just the next trend in order for us to make sure that we can stay up with what we need to do for our communities.
Of course, another big trend in the world of information and reading is the e-reader or reading books on tablets. Mm-hmm. What are libraries doing to keep up with that?
Well, within the state of Wisconsin, the public libraries created a consortium to offer e-books to the entire state of Wisconsin. So we have, I don't even remember the number, I should have looked it up for you, but we have thousands of titles that people can borrow and download onto various devices for a set period of time, and then it expires. So we're making sure that those books are available not only in print but also in electronic format when possible.
It's kind of conceptually weird. I mean, I know libraries do that, but the idea that you check out basically the data that is a book for a finite amount of time and then it expires.
Yes.
Are people embracing this? Are people checking these out?
They are, and there are, you know, waiting times. I've gone online a couple of times to find a particular book, and I see, oh, well, look, there's a long waiting list. I'll put my name in, and in a couple of weeks, or, you know, I get my email that says it's ready. But in the meantime, I found something else that I didn't think about, and I downloaded something right away. There are also a lot of libraries are offering to download audiobooks, so you can make those car rides and the commutes to work a little bit more interesting.
We're talking to Paula Ganyard. She's Wisconsin Library Association President, Library Director of the David A. Coffrin Library at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay.
And we want to know what you think about libraries. Are they still important now that almost everyone has the internet at home? Do you still go to your local library? Do you hang out there? You can call and tell us about your experience at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on our Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls in a few minutes. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
We'll pick up our conversation about libraries now with Paula Ganyard. She's president of the Wisconsin Library Association. That organization is meeting in Green Bay this week for their annual convention, talking about the role of libraries here in Wisconsin.
And we're asking what you think about libraries. Do you still use them? And how important do you see them in your life and in your community's life? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Amy with us in Dousman. Amy, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I love our local library. I didn't have one growing up, so I appreciate all that much more. I have young children, and I use our library as a way to demonstrate values to my children and what I think is important. So the library is a destination for us, and it's a place we go for mommy dates, and they can check out whatever books they want. And then that trickles into our home life, too, because we go to the library to pick something out to enjoy together at home. So I'm showing them that it's important to have knowledge and to be exposed to many things and to experience it together. And I like the third-party endorsement that is provided through, you know, that librarian behind the counter. And I also like personally knowing that the library still offers accessibility to people who can't afford to, you know, buy the books at the book fair or through Scholastic, that there's still somewhere that their children can go to be on an even par in terms of learning.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. Paula, a lot there. But can you talk about how libraries try to serve families?
Sure. We try to make a welcoming space and an opportunity for people to grow at all ages. Some examples, and Rob, at the beginning of the program, you mentioned you're married to a librarian who I know and like quite a bit.
Me too.
So at the Columbus Public Library, you might be familiar with the Getting Ready to Read program that they do. So they start off very early, and they give gift bags from the library that includes a board book and coupons for parents to go to learn about literacy and how they model the way for them on how to read to their children. We then have places like the Lester Public Library, where they have Scholar for Life program, and UW-Manitowoc faculty members will go to that library and share research interests. And they're bringing in people of all ages from their community as well as neighboring communities. So we go the spectrum from one end to the next. And Amy said there that she loves the local library. That's one of the best things about being a librarian is everyone loves us. It's really a great job to have.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Lori in Milwaukee now. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thank you so much for being there. The library has been a lifeline for me my entire life. I was a neglected and abused child and was able to go to the library to escape. I learned many things. I loved just everything about it. The librarians I hold in high reverence. And as I became older, even got jobs there part-time at the Central Library downtown. And my favorite part of that was, of course, going down into stacks and pulling rare books out for certain requests and for the rare books room. It was wonderful, still is wonderful. I use my library. I am there usually about two or three times a week. I have about 3 books now and 4 DVDs, and always have something pretty much coming at all times. I own a television that I very rarely, really, really use, and I just can't tell you how many different people, authors, poets, artists that I've seen down at Centennial Hall at the library, off and on in my entire life, and have made a lifelong friend of one particular poet, E. Ethelbert Miller, who I met about 5 years ago there.
All right.
We still talk to this day.
Thanks a lot.
Email,
letter. I want to leave time for some responses and more calls, Lori, but thank you so much for sharing your story, Paula.
Well, the Milwaukee part is, first of all, it's a beautiful library down there, so I really like that one. They now just started something very new. When talking about cutting edge, they're putting vending machines in housing developments in Milwaukee. They have hold about 200-plus books, and it's the first one in the state to try to go out and put the information where the people are if they just can't get to the local library.
So it's a vending machine where you can check out books like you would over at the library.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting. Well, thank you again for that call. And Nina in Germantown emails, I spent so much time in my local public library when I was growing up that the director told my mother I was going to be a librarian. I laughed at the time, but I'm now in my second career. I'm a very happy librarian. And she goes on, speaking of electronic books, a few months ago, someone asked me when public libraries in Wisconsin were going to start offering ebooks. I said, we've been offering them for over 13 years. Libraries need to do a better job of marketing themselves. Thanks for that, Nina. Is that the case? Or is there a lot we don't know that's out there in libraries, Paula?
That is the case, and that's actually one of the things that our new executive director of the Wisconsin Library Association has been talking to us. He's only been on the job for 15 days, but he's already saying, you know, we have this value where everybody loves libraries, but we need to get that story out more. And so that is something that we're experts at trying to find information and provide people. We're not the marketing experts, so we need to find those collaborations and make sure we get that word out.
Before we go back to the phones, we've been hearing lately as we talk about the Affordable Care Act that people can go to a number of or some places to sign up for things online, including the library. Are libraries trying to be a source of information on signing up for the Affordable Care Act?
Libraries provide information on all sorts of things. So for years, we provided IRS tax forms. We provide all sorts of government information. And so the Affordable Care Act is just one more topic that we provide that information. For some libraries, they have been questioned maybe by their local municipalities or governing boards as to whether or not information on that should be provided because it is a politically hot topic. But what we're there for is to provide people with the information. We're not lawyers, we're not tax experts. We just provide people with that information regardless of what the topic is.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Aaron with us in Fond du Lac. Aaron, hi.
Hi there. Hey, wanted to make a couple comments here. Pretty much my whole family uses the library systems, and including my wife and I and our children who are under the ages of five. And we have some very wonderful programs, especially in North Fond du Lac. It's become kind of a community-centered thing, and kids get together, they learn about reading, education, exploring all sorts of things, and it's a wonderful avenue for them. And especially me, in my job role, I have found that libraries, especially bigger ones, tend to be a better source of information than the internet can ever offer. And the further that usually I research a topic, the more limited I find the internet to actually be. And so I kind of feel that we're losing a lot of maybe historical information because it's not being electronically kept now. And so I do use libraries quite a bit.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Aaron. Paul, what do you think about his statement, finding deeper, better information at the library than he can online?
I'd love to hear that. we'd like to, the internet is a wonderful resource. We do not disregard it. It's often, the first spot we'll go to help people. But what we want to do is, what we can do that the internet can't do is turn around and ask you the next question. What exactly do you mean by this? Or we can see your facial expression when we're talking to you and clearly we're not understanding it. The internet doesn't see that. So what we can do is help you get through the problem and try to get to what you're really looking for that you maybe didn't think you did. Were looking for.
Through years of using libraries in my hometown, at college, and beyond, I never had the notion to go up and ask a librarian a question and ask for help, even though I sure could have used it. What can the librarian offer me when I go, or anyone, when they go to the library?
Well, academic libraries where I'm from, so you wouldn't be the first student or last student that I've ever heard that from. We actually like to tell people that had they come in earlier, your GPA probably would have been higher. There's studies that show that. What we can help people with is starting with, what topic do you want to do? If they don't even know the topic, but here's the assignment. I got to write a paper. Mm-hmm. We can help you start to think through the topic. We can find some different resources for you. We can help you make the looking at the resources and deciding this is going to be more of a credible resource than this particular resource, making those judgments as to what is a valid resource. So there's all sorts of ways in which we can
help out.
Would have helped my GPA for sure. Well, just a minute or so left. What's next for libraries? What is on the horizon?
Whatever our customers need is what will be on the horizon. We just continue to try to meet the needs of the folks in our communities and continue to try to make communities better. We're reaching out and doing more collaborations, so we're really looking towards talking with other social service areas within our communities. And I'm hoping some of those people are listening and will think about, gee, maybe I should go talk to the library and see what kind of things that they can help us out. And we're all stronger together if we come together and help our communities.
All right, Paula, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Paula Ganyard. She's Wisconsin Library Association president. She's the library director of the David A. Coffrin Library at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
Coming up, a look at frac sand mining in Wisconsin and a proposed law that would change the way the mines are regulated. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the show, we'll be taking a look at some of the legendary creatures and monsters that call Wisconsin their home.
First, a heated public hearing was held today over a bill that would limit the ability of local governments to regulate frac sand mining, which has increased significantly in recent years.
Joining us now is Gilman Halstead, WPR's reporter. He was at the hearing today. Gilman, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me.
Always, anytime, man. So we sort of touched on it in our little lead in there. What exactly would this bill do?
Well, it would change something that was enacted through a state Supreme Court ruling in February of last year that gave townships the ability to enter into licensing agreements outside of zoning ordinances in restricting the way frac sand mining is done in their communities. It would allow them to monitor the environmental impact and basically to have a memorandum of agreement with the company about what they will do and what they won't. And so this bill would take that power away to a large extent. And people living in those towns and the Township Association is very much opposed to it. The industry is very much in favor of it, because they find these agreements that they have to go into limit their ability to expand the industry.
And townships have been making use of that Supreme Court ruling, right?
Yes, they have been. Trempealeau County passed a moratorium. That means there can be no more frac sand mines opened. There have been an incredible number of them opened just over the past 3 years, actually. I think it's more than tripled the number of mines that are there. And people in the townships, by enacting the moratorium, have said, let's slow down, do some monitoring, try to get the Department of Natural Resources more involved in keeping track of the environmental and health impacts these might have. There are no studies right now that show there's an impact, but people are concerned.
So take us to today's hearing. How big a turnout was there?
Well, it was not overly packed. They did have some extra rooms set up for people to listen in. There were no seats available in the actual hearing room, and I didn't see how full the other rooms were. But I was not there to hear any, actually, of the testimony given by sort of the township residents, the quote-unquote real people. Most of what went on for the majority of the hearing was the industry and the Townships Association and environmental groups presenting, and unions actually, presenting their take.
So on the pro side, the people arguing for this new legislation, you mentioned the unions. What did they have to say about why they were supporting this?
Because this industry is providing an incredible number of jobs for all sorts of construction workers and engineers who are building these plants and running the running them once they're up. And we know that the job situation has been bad, and they're concerned that these what they call the hodgepodge of regulations that are being enacted by townships will discourage the expansion of this industry and result in fewer jobs. So they what they want is the state to set up some standard, and this is what the bill would do, that the state would be in charge of making all of the environmental decisions through the DNR and also through, of course, the Environmental Protection Agency, and restrict the towns from enacting any of their own health and environmental regulation or even monitoring programs.
So presumably critics of the bill are worried that what comes from this statewide regulation might be less rigorous than what they might be able to impose on a local level?
Right. And they're also concerned that the DNR does not have the staffing ability, the money and personnel to go out and really follow what's going on. They're, the state representative from Trempealeau County, Representative Dano, has a bill pending that would actually add 10 more staff members to the DNR to be able specifically to monitor this burgeoning industry. That's not part of this bill, and he was there to testify today saying don't pass this bill until the DNR has the ability to actually do what you're now saying the towns shouldn't be doing.
And I saw some of the state's environmental groups were trying to rally people to come and speak against this. What's their take there?
Well, it's really similar. I mean, they are jumping on the local control bandwagon and saying that, that the people who live in these towns who have to deal with the sand in the air, the trucks on the roads, that they should be the ones who have some voice in how the industry is regulated. But they're also concerned in the larger picture, of course, about the whole energy debate going on, that this is being driven by the fossil fuel industry, and environmental groups are concerned that we shouldn't be expanding our fossil fuel extraction. We should be working on alternatives.
Because ultimately, this sand mine in Wisconsin gets used elsewhere for fracking operations for natural gas.
Exactly.
So when it was introduced, when I first heard about it, it had that feel of something that was moving quickly, this new legislation. Does it still feel that way today?
No, I get the sense that things may slow down a little bit here. Wisconsin Counties Association testified today saying they'd gotten assurances from the bill's authors, Senator Tiffany and Representative Ballwig, that they would sit down and talk with them about things they'd like to see change that would retain some local control over these things. And there was a big push from some other opponents that we really had to back off even further and have what you call a legislative council committee sit down and bring in all the stakeholders and really look at the industry and its impact in a much more comprehensive way before moving ahead with the bill.
And do the sponsors seem open to making changes?
Well, I think I don't think on the legislative council front that they want to back off that far, but they are trying to assure people like the Wisconsin Counties Association and the Wisconsin Township Association that they will take their concerns seriously and that this is only the starting point and changes can be made.
And there were protests outside at the Capitol, or at least people were trying to rally them last I saw.
Right, yes. There were some protests outside. Those were focused very strongly on local control and people really concerned about the fact that that the writing of this bill involved the authors sitting down with the industry and coming up with the changes that the industry wants and being concerned that local people were not really involved in that process and were sort of didn't really hear about the bill until 10 days ago or so.
Well, as with just about anything related to mining and legislation in Wisconsin, this is one we're probably going to be talking about for a while.
Right. It may actually be there may be some connections to the iron mine because there's some concerns. The iron mine in the Pinocchio Hills, there's some concerns that some of the provisions in the bill will make it harder to regulate blasting ordinances for the work that's going on in the Pinocchio Hills for that big iron mine.
Oh, is that one of the concerns that was raised today?
Yes, that was raised today by Senator Jauch, who represents the area.
All right. Gilman, thank you so much for being with us today. That was Gilman Halstead, reporter here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up next, we'll go monster hunting right here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're listening to Central Time. Our next guest went looking for stories of unexplained beasts and bizarre creatures in the state, and he was not disappointed.
Joining us now is Casey Steinbrink. He's a writer and producer at Who Knew, an arts and culture website covering the Fox Cities. And his piece, Seven Strange Stories of Wisconsin Monsters, plus one from Upper Michigan, is up on our Facebook page. Casey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, you guys.
Well, you start with probably the most popular Wisconsin monster, the Hodag.
Yeah,
tell
the
us
Hodag.
About that.
Well, the Hodag, a lot of people have heard of the Hodag and they know what the Hodag looks like. But I think the most interesting thing about the Hodag is the guy who discovered or maybe perhaps invented the Hodag. His name was Eugene Shepherd or Gene Shepherd, and he was a well-known prankster in Rhinelander. So the Hodag was probably his most elaborate plan, but it's one that's really stuck with Wisconsin lore through the years. So he told people here, I would like to read a passage of how he described the Hodag.
Sure.
It's from a book called Wisconsin Lore, which I used to do some of the research for this story. And the authors sat down with people all over Wisconsin getting different anecdotes on everything from like the circus to the lumberjack days to Native American legends. And so there's also stories about different weird Wisconsin creatures and ghosts and stuff like that in here too. So here's how Gene Shepherd described the Hodag. He said the animal's back resembled that of a dinosaur, and its tail, which extended to an enormous length, had a spear-like end. Sharp spines 1.5 feet apart lined the spinal column. The legs were short and massive, and the claws were thick and curved, denoting great strength. The broad furrowed forehead was covered with coarse shaggy hair and bore two large horns. From the broad muscular mouth, sharp glistening white teeth protruded. So sounds pretty creepy.
Yeah.
And if you've ever seen a picture of a Hodag, it actually is a little bit more funny looking than creepy, I think, personally. But so this hoax that Eugene Shepherd pulled went on for a pretty long time. He took a search party out into the woods where they allegedly killed a Hodag, and there's a really kind of comical picture of this group of men standing around a charred Hodag because apparently they had to use dynamite to take it out.
So what led him to give up on the hoax eventually?
Well, he allegedly captured another Hodag, and he started taking it around with him, a live one, to county fairs. And he had it rigged up so that it would move when people would walk in the tent and people would get all freaked out. So eventually the Smithsonian Institute caught wind of this Hodag story, and they were going to come to check it out. So that's when Gene Shepherd said, okay, I made this all up. It was just a joke. And I don't think too many people were surprised since he there's literally a chapter in this book, Wisconsin Lore, pretty much dedicated to all the little tricks he played on people.
Yeah.
So
know about this Hodag, Casey. What about one that is maybe more plausible that you had to go, maybe that one is a harder to dismiss?
Well, there is a Wisconsin werewolf known as the Beast of Ray Road. And maybe it's maybe not necessarily a werewolf. No one's ever seen it change. Something changed from a human to a man. But it's this wolf-like, dog-like creature that has shown up in different parts of Wisconsin. And there's been a journalist who actually she was working for the Walworth County Week, and she was asked to investigate some of these claims of this wolf beast that people had been seeing. And she ended up quitting her job at the paper and trying to track this Beast of Bray Road, and that made a career out of it, basically. So there are a lot of stories about this wolf-like creature that stands up on two legs and eats with its hands, like palm-like hands. So it has some human-like features and stuff like that. There's a similar one in Michigan known as the Michigan Wolfman. So there are a lot of different theories about what this could be. Some people think it's a cryptological beast called the Wahila, which is a kind of a prehistoric wolf animal. But that's one that, you know, has never really been disproven. Although, you know, of course, a lot of these stories happen to people who happened to be, you know, inebriated at the time, or they were just in a one of the stories about the Beast of Bray Road is a guy who is going along a highway picking up roadkill and throwing it in the back of the truck working for the highway department, and when he was getting in his truck, he felt a big bang in the back of the vehicle and looked back and saw this animal taking out the roadkill that he had loaded in the back. So besides. Go ahead.
Is there a sense that this one might be a hoax like the Hodag was?
Well, you know, there are skeptics about everything, and I'm a skeptic too, but I'm also a skeptic who believes anything's possible, right? There's weird things out there.
Some of these are really quirky. You write about some human-like creatures known as the Haunchies. I've never heard of the Haunchies before.
Well, the Haunchies, the story goes for the Haunchies, is they were little people who worked for the circus at one time and then left the circus and started their own little colony. And it's the Haunchies, this group of people apparently lived in around Muskego on a plot of land on a place called Mystic Road, which is a pretty good name. but apparently there was a man who sat in a pickup truck who would fire a warning shot if you're getting too close to what they called Haunchyville, where there were these small buildings where the people lived. And if you went into this area, they would come out and beat you up and possibly kill you. So kind of a freaky story, but it's one of those urban legends that it's kind of had some legs.
it's one of the more plausible ones. It doesn't require believing in an otherwise undiscovered form of life. They're people in the legend.
Right. And, you know, you have to keep in mind a lot of these stories are, you know, anecdotes and you know, tall tales that get blown up and exaggerated over time. But that's sort of the fun of it, especially as we're in the Halloween season, having those fun stories to tell that are connected to state history.
There's one that I'm really interested in because I used to, I think, drive this stretch of highway around Ridgeway and Dodgeville, and there used to be this old rundown house there, and someone for years had spray painted Home of Ghost on it.
Oh, really?
And, you know, I used to hear from local people around there about like a ghostly dog on that stretch of highway, different manifestations. But tell us what you know about the Ridgeway ghost.
Well, the Ridgeway ghost might be the most most well-known ghost in Wisconsin. He's been making appearances since the 1840s. And it can show up as anything. It could be a man who would show up riding next to someone on a buggy, one of the more interesting stories in this book, Wisconsin Lore, is about some guys who were playing a poker game, and there were three of them at the table, and suddenly there was a fourth person at the table who grabbed the deck and started dealing. And as they would start picking up their cards when the guy dealt, the cards would zip out of their hand and start flying around the room. So, but again, the authors of this book kind of point out tongue-in-cheek that the Ridgeway ghost, he has been seen by many persons, some of whom were sober.
I want to get to some of the other creatures, but first, have communities embraced these? I know Rhinelander is big on the Hodag. There's a big Hodag sculpture there. They've made that part of their community. Anybody else taken on their local creature as a logo, a mascot?
Well, you know, not that I'm really aware of, not to the extent of the Hodag. You know, they have the country music festival. The Hodag has even worked his way into mainstream pop culture. He was even featured in a episode of the most recent version of Scooby-Doo, where the meddling kids had to figure out that the Hodag was just a hoax. So I don't know if anything has quite become, you know, to the extent of the Hodag. Although the Paulding Light, which is something our Upper Michigan story, that is kind of a local tourist attraction that the locals, when you talk to them, at least they seem like they very much believe that it's something's going on up there. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of the Paulding Light before, but it's if you're in the town of Watersmeet, and Watersmeet is famous for being the home of the Nimrods, that's their high school
mascot.
Yeah. There's a place in Watersmeet where you're looking towards Paulding, and you're looking across this valley of power lines, and you see this light that pops up over the valley. It happens every night, and it just kind of, it's a single beam of light that kind of emerges and flickers and grows and then disappears. So it's been unexplained for a really long time. There have been different people who tried to prove it was different things like car headlights on a distant highway. But then others would say, well, the highway doesn't really run that direction, so it can't be that. And the Sci-Fi Network even went out there to investigate it. And they determined that they couldn't conclude what the light actually was.
Wow. Well, that's an interesting one. And, you know, we're not just talking about land creatures and lights. It sounds like there are some strange things going on in Wisconsin water, too.
Yeah, we have – in our article, we have several stories of lake monsters. And there are probably a lot more out there that I haven't included in this article. But some of the more interesting ones – one, near Madison in Lake Mendota, there's a popular character called Bozho. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of him. But he's sort of a good-natured water monster, apparently. And the one of the most often told stories about Bozho is these two UW students were sunbathing in the 70s by the lake, and they had their feet dangling in the water. And the girl thought her boyfriend was tickling her feet because she kept feeling something tickle the soles of her feet. But then she looked over at him and saw he was sound asleep. So she looked down in the water and saw this face of a sea serpent looking up at her and apparently was smiling at her with a mischievous grin. And so after that people started having sightings of this Bozho all the time, and apparently he would tip over people's canoes, which, you know, if you fall out of your canoe is a pretty good excuse that a sea monster tipped you over.
Named Bozho.
Bozho. Casey, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yes. Thanks for having me, guys.
Casey Steinbrink is a writer and producer at Who Knew. That's an arts and culture website covering the Fox Cities. We've got a link to his article on the Monsters of Wisconsin on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also read up on monsters in Devil's Lake and Lake Winnebago as well. So check that out.
Be curious to know if there are any local monsters where you live, too. Maybe something of local lore that we've missed that Casey doesn't cover in his article.
Or a
Let
ghost
us
story,
know.
Yeah.
Yep. Tis the season to think about ghosts. You can do that at the Central Time Facebook page. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out why the moose population is on the decline in Minnesota and elsewhere, and what wildlife biologists are trying to do about it.
And pumpkins will be the subject of our Food Friday segment. We're not just talking about seeds. We'll learn about some new ways to get creative with them in the kitchen, savory and sweet, I think.
And we'll be joined by conservative columnist Ann Coulter. We'll talk to her about her new book. It's called Never Trust a Liberal Over Three.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, some scary book recommendations just in time for Halloween. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.